This is an interview with Chester Spatt for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm Ken Durr. Today is May 4th, 2017, and we're speaking in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk. I want to start by going way back and talk about your education, but I want to hear about why economics. How did you come to into that field?
Well, I've always been fascinated by markets. I was always very good in math and abstract thinking. I was sort of more interested in understanding society, and so I was interested, more focused on social sciences rather than the sciences, despite my interest in math. I also did something a little bit unusual when I was in college, and it's going to sound like this was the path for my being a lawyer, but ultimately became the path for my being an economist, and that was I sued the state of New York. I challenged the constitutionality of the state law that denied me a Regents scholarship, which was a very small scholarship, by the way, because I went to an out-of-state school. I grew up in Brooklyn, and the out-of-state school that I went to was Princeton, and the core of my legal argument, well, it was twofold. It was partially that this was a denial of my fundamental right to travel, and there were various equal protection clause cases along those lines, and also that I was buying a good from a New Jersey producer, and there were court precedents that New York couldn't impose special taxes on eggs from New Jersey, and so I argued that I was buying a good from a New Jersey producer. So the case was initially assigned in the federal court to Judge Jack Weinstein, who's still a senior. So this was a long time ago, but Jack Weinstein was assigned to him. He was a senior judge. He ruled that I had a meritorious enough claim that he decided that I should get a three-judge panel, which was how it worked at the time if you wanted to overturn state law. But unfortunately, the three judges felt that they did not agree with my position. And in fact, I thought my stronger argument was my commerce argument, because I felt that this, and in fact, basically, it was an argument about partially the Interstate Commerce Clause, but in effect, it was an argument of comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. I think the court said was that they kind of viewed this argument as ingenious but unrealistic. We need not tarry over this argument. But I viewed the core of that argument as basically the argument of comparative advantage in economics. And, right. You know, it sort of illustrated sort of an early stage, my interest in thinking about matters from the point of view of economic principles.
Huh. That, I was also intrigued by your PhD dissertation. Mm-hmm. The title, something like Three Essays in the Economics of Finance. And I mean, it sounds like an 18th century, 19th century economist take on things.
Well, I'm not sure.
It's got that sort of broad general.
Yeah. In the era when I got my PhD, and actually continuing now to today, doctoral students increasingly are writing several essays, several papers. They're writing typically, and it sort of started roughly around that time that people would write a few papers, and I think the notion was that in economics and finance that books were not the main mechanism of publication, papers were, and in order to feed into that process most naturally in terms of a prospective faculty member's development, the three essays model, sometimes it was two essays or five essays, but that model seemed like a better model. So this was actually becoming relatively standard then.
Okay.
But when people have a more synthetic set of papers that fit particularly closely together, they come up with a more specific title.
Yeah, I'm used to hearing the very specific specialized PhD dissertation titles. So did you You got your degree at Penn, is that
That's
right?
correct, yeah.
That's right?
Yeah.
And then...
I was a PhD student at Penn. I worked under Stephen Ross, who was at the time a rising star, really a rising superstar. Unfortunately, he passed away about 6 weeks ago, but he certainly was a major figure in the finance discipline over much of the last close to half century.
And then, did you go into teaching at Carnegie Mellon?
Yes, I did.
At that point?
Carnegie Mellon was that's where I became a faculty member.
And what was your specialty? How did your specialty develop over those years?
Well, so in the early years, I was primarily a theorist by training. I tended to work on problems in applied microeconomic theory, particularly problems in industrial organization and finance. And some of my early papers were sort of at the interface between those. So I did work. Some of my early papers in finance focused on some game theoretic issues in finance. For example, I have a study of an obscure instrument called sinking fund bonds and some of the strategic issues that arose at the time with those instruments. I had a number of early studies of mortgage contracting. I was writing about mortgages in 19, with one of my collaborators at Carnegie Mellon at the time, Ken Dunn. We were writing about mortgages in the 1980s, long before, you know, mortgages became as sort of as hot a topic as they certainly became years later. And so I sort of studied various contractual issues at the time with mortgages.
Did you develop a more general interest in markets?
Yeah, I certainly had very broad interests in markets, not only in the mortgage markets. One of the directions I went in a number of my studies was to look at equity markets in various contexts, partially from the point of view of investor decision making, and I've written some of the key papers on taxes and asset allocation. Some of my work on both on the trade-offs between paying capital gains taxes and diversifying, and also on asset location, what to put in your taxable and tax-deferred accounts. These I think are considered perhaps the leading papers on some of those problems. Mortgages and the area of taxes and asset allocation are sort of other areas that I'm sort of known for in the finance community, aside from my interest in market structure and broad regulatory issues, which really sort of blossomed partially in the aftermath of my service at the SEC. Certainly the broader interest in financial regulation blossomed in the aftermath, and particularly with the financial crisis, but also in the aftermath of my service at the SEC. But I started really working in market structure around 1990, partially as a byproduct of a visit to France with a young researcher. I had the opportunity to visit the Paris Bourse, and I asked lots of questions, and you know, I think he and I hit it off, and he and another collaborator were able to obtain data, and we started studying this data, and what emerged from that was the first published paper on electronic limit order books. And in fact, it's now my most cited paper. This paper published in the Journal of Finance in 1995 that looks at the dynamics of the limit order book and the interaction of the limit orders of the book and the order flow. So this is really what really kind of crystallized some of my interest in market structure. Now, some of this also was a byproduct that I had occasions where I would be doing some modest trading, and so I would think about, well, what's my best order strategy, and where do I want to place the order relative to the quote? And so this paper was very synergistic with that. But it's also, you know, I think one of the reasons it wound up being widely cited was that the prior, you know, gradually there was an evolution in the type of data that academics had. And so first academics, of course, just had, finance professors had prices. And then they started getting quotes. Well, we went kind of one level further down. We not only had, in effect, quotes like bid and ask, we had the orders. So we had the orders on both sides of the market going a certain way. We had the five best. We had basically the five best prices on each side of the book over a limited sample for the Paris Bourse. Now, people kind of wondered at the time, well, why did we study Paris? Well, partially that was the data we had, but also this was a self-contained market. It would have been actually, in some respects, much harder to study the limit order, the order book, and the order flow with the New York Stock Exchange, because that was a market which had significant manual components, as illustrated by some of the aspects of the specialist system. Now, there were studies of using that data from there, too.
Right.
But I think one of the advantages that our context brought to bear was it was a self-contained, was that our data was really kind of capturing the full market dynamics. So it was really quite an intriguing market to study. And then this study led to a number of other studies that I did in the equity market structure area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, soon after, then we studied. So. This initial paper was published in the Journal of Finance in 1995. We then did a study of how the opening worked in Paris. And we had very interesting data because we got indicative. There were communications that were occurring that were non-binding before the market opened. And so let's say the market opened at 10 a.m. We would have communications earlier that morning, and we constructed virtual prices. That what happened if the market actually did open then? But that was kind of just a hypothetical. And we looked at the behavior of the virtual prices, and we saw there was a lot of efficiency. So early on in the morning, the virtual prices were just garbage; they were just noise. But later on, they had a lot of, in the last 10 minutes or so, they had a lot of predictive power about the opening. And so we sort of explored some of that, and we wound up with a very nice paper in the Journal of Political Economy, which is one of the leading broad-based journals in all of economics. So I did that with the same collaborators, Bruno Bia and Pierre Hillion, that I did the earlier study on the order book and the order flow. And Bruno Bia and I, we continued to work in the market structure area. We did a survey of the market structure area in which we partnered with Larry Glosten, who was one of the theoretical founders of the market microstructure area, and that was at the final stages of the pre-publication process, right at the time of my arrival at the commission.
Okay.
So that was sort of a nice circumstances. It was also sort of nice that we sort of had it done, so that. Legal colleagues on the staff kind of felt like they didn't need to vet our product, because I'm sure our paper had lots to say about many regulatory issues, and so it was sort of nice that it was sort of done before I arrived. I also did along the way. We did it, and actually it was sort of the talk that I gave at the time that I was that the commission was starting to think about me, and I was starting to think about the commission. I gave a talk on some work on competition and tick size. We also wound up being able to study a situation where the traditional NASDAQ had a relatively wider tick, and there was this platform called Island that was quoting much finer ticks within the NASDAQ framework, but really kind of almost on the side. And it was consistent with the rules, but it was interesting to see how the competition worked. And we wound up with a very nice paper about that was in Management Science. So this is sort of how my... For reasons that I didn't really appreciate at the time, I didn't understand at the time, this winds up actually being closely related to some of the issues in regulation NMS. Because NMS, of course, had to do with fragmentation and competition. Right. And in a way, this was a pre-NMS cut at these issues, although it's taken me a long time to really fully grasp the whole connection.
Yeah. There's one thing that popped up that I'm intrigued by, and it's sort of a side excursion, but you did some work for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Oh, yeah, and that actually kind of played an important, that played an interesting role. So I worked with them, I was a consultant to them in their investigation of manipulation in the Western energy markets. So I worked closely with them in that investigation, and ultimately, in fact, actually, my predecessor wound up hiring one of the attorneys I was sort of working with over there for the staff, and then I think my predecessor also viewed this as a signal that I might have an Potomac fever, so. This encouraged him, my involvement in this other project, encouraged him to cultivate me to think seriously, perhaps about coming down to be his successor. Now, ultimately, of course, a director doesn't choose his successor, but my predecessor did play, Larry Harris did play an important role in encouraging my interest and then passing that along to Bill Donaldson, who was the chair.
Was the energy market? Was there a lot of sort of comparability between the energy market and the securities markets? Were you using the same sorts of concepts when you?
Well, to some degree. So I also had papers. So one of my other papers that's gotten a fair bit of attention is an equilibrium model of forward curve dynamics. Basically, what's the shape of the forward curve? How are short term versus long term prices determined? What's the role of storage? We have a model in which storage helps clear the market, and so it's more of a pricing model based upon an economic foundation, but because of my background in market structure, together with my expertise in that type of model, I think that's why FERC was interested in involved me in their investigation of the Western energy markets. So are some of the market structure issues similar? Yeah, but it's a different, some of it were quite different. And of course, in that market, Enron was playing a pivotal role, and so obviously the market structure, it's a very different kind of, it was a very different kind of market structure, certainly than equity. It's a very different structure because it was an over-the-counter. It certainly, for the most of, not all the markets even at the time, but many of the markets were over-the-counter markets. The products were, they were more like derivative type products and the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start moving. You talked about Larry Harris, and you sort of came into his crosshairs at some point.
Well, I wouldn't say in his crosshairs. No, we got along well.
Tell me a little bit about when you first found out that this might be a possibility, and I want to get a sense of maybe the tradition of that office, the Office of the Economic Advisor, and sort of your understanding of the past with that role and what you might be looking toward.
So I think historically the chief economist, the person who was the chief economist I think historically the person who was chief economist was often at a relatively younger career stage than I think many of the other directors. I think that started to change with Larry, and certainly changed then with me, and I think this really continued now with the recent chief economists as well. But I think historically many of the folks who had been chief economists were doing it at relatively earlier stages in their careers, maybe within about 10 years or so of the PhD. You know, if you go back and look, many of the folks were within about 10 years of the PhD, and both Larry and I were both 20 plus years, and you know, you see that Mark Flannery, who recently stepped down, you know, I think Mark got his PhD in mid 1970s. So there's been sort of a sea change, you know, and I think this is what makes it more comparable. You know, these sort of longer lengths make it more comparable to the other directors, and I think to some extent, you know, there's been, you know, so there. But I think historically, one of the issues I think, I think the academic community looks at the role in sort of an interesting way, because on the one hand there's an appreciation that, you know, that's it's important to have a person with with a fair bit of savvy in the role, and I think historically we've had, you know, throughout, I think the people who have been chief economists are terrific group over the many decades. I think at the same time, I think there's also some skepticism in the academic community because of the perception that the SEC is a lawyer-dominated agency, and maybe that perhaps that's what you were alluding to.
Yeah.
So there is certainly that perception, and I think to some extent it's probably a relatively fair perspective. I think most chief economists, myself included, I think I've tried to push on that. I think in recent years there's probably been more success. And I think some of that greater success in pushing on that actually owes itself to a combination of the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals and the Commission's failure initially to really understand the message from the Circuit Court of Appeals, which kind of led the Circuit Court to then escalate its voice.
Right.
So if one goes back. So when I was chief economist, one of the controversial rulemakings, which actually I think happened right before I arrived, was the mutual fund independent chair and independent directors rule.
Right.
And of course, this was contested, and a year into my time at the commission. And 9 days before Bill Donaldson's resignation was to be effective, the Circuit Court overturned the rule, but it stayed the rule, and you know, basically told the SEC you had to do a proper cost benefit analysis, and the SEC then turned it around because the SEC declared that it wanted to have the same five commissioners adjudicate the response. They turned this around in 8 days. And I think the circuit, it's clear from the Circuit Court ruling, the Circuit Court found that insulting, basically, and lifted the stay, and 6 months later, kind of fully drove the nail on that issue. And then 6 years later, I think the Circuit Court must have concluded that things hadn't changed, because they took certainly the rhetoric in the proxy access decision. Was I think a lot of observers felt it was very aggressive. And I think my view as a non-lawyer was, oh no, you don't understand. Without aggressive rhetoric, obviously the commission wasn't going to get the message. And so, you know, it seemed to me like as a non-lawyer, this seemed to me eminently fair. And I think it was actually the Circuit Court ruling was very helpful to the SEC, because I think then the SEC understood. And then it beefed up its efforts in the cost-benefit space in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, see, this raises the question, so why didn't they beef up the efforts earlier?
And I think that Donaldson wanted to do that.
But he was only there for 9 days after the ruling, so I don't understand your point. Because he was not. I mean, you know, but I think Chris Cox did want to. Chris Cox, I think, did want to do that. And Brian Cartwright, who became his general counsel and who I thought was a terrific general counsel, I think he wanted to do that. And Brian was certainly, you know, was very much of an intellectual. Mm-hmm. You know, has a PhD in physics, for example. I mean, he's very much, you know, he's not right. Very much of an intellectual. Let me just sort of leave it at that. But you know, we had some meetings about this. But, and I think things were going to, I sense, we had some meetings about this once Chairman Cox, you know, was really kind of putting everything together at the agency. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, this wasn't the initial priority, obviously. I think dealing with the specific issues to some extent were, because you know, those were clearly very important. And I think, you know, people were looking at him, I think, unfairly skeptically. But, you know, there's a tendency in Washington, if you don't do exactly what your predecessor does, they kind of think that you're not true to some mission. Well, the mission, you know, of course, you know, the mission isn't necessarily defined by what your predecessor did. You know, that's not, you know, it was defined by what your predecessor did when your predecessor was in charge.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's something I was referring to. Shortly after you came in, there was an announcement that the SEC was going to, when you're in the rulemaking process, the SEC decided they're going to do the cost-benefit analysis at the beginning rather than at the end of that process. Does that ring a bell at all?
No, yeah. It actually doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
So that there was, in response to the circuit court, there were some internal... You know, I think Brian Cartwright was leading an initiative on this that was really beginning around the time that I was leaving. So I was chief economist for just over 3 years. I was there for 37 months from beginning of July 04 to end of July 07. And I think toward the end, Cartwright and Cox were beginning an initiative along. You know, I think with the circuit court ruling in mind, but kind of taking a bigger, longer view. Now, I don't know, as an outsider, you know, obviously I wasn't party to much of the internal deliberations after the initial meetings, but I suspect that the financial crisis was so consuming for the commission that this just disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because I think they would have been sympathetic to taking cost benefit analysis more seriously.
Okay.
But I think the financial crisis it just consumed, you know, everything on the radar, and the financial crisis was beginning in this period.
Right.
I can recall at some of my last senior staff meetings, we were being briefed on the collapse of one Bear Stearns hedge fund and the collapse of the second Bear Stearns hedge fund. In the first case, Bear Stearns decided to put money in. In the second case, they decided not to put money in. And you know, this was kind of some of the initial seeds of what was to come, both at Bear Stearns 9 months later, and then, you know. And actually, within basically, so my last official day at the commission was July 31st. On August, I think it was August 9th, but shortly, in early August, there was what was, I think, now been referred to as the quantitative meltdown or the hedge fund meltdown. There were these huge shocks in some of the mortgage markets in particular. There were huge pricing shocks, and this really got the attention of the authorities. And I think many observers now trace the beginnings of the financial crisis in terms of market signals to that activity. You know, and then you started to see, you know, in some ways, although it wasn't really reflected in the stock price at the time, you started to see, you know, really bad news starting to come out of places like Citigroup. Although their stock, for a while, their stock price kind of held up, but you started to see, and you started to see like write downs, and you started to see, you know, but it, you know, in 2008 it really kind of increased. But it's easy to imagine in that kind of environment, there just wouldn't have been the energy to really. But I think taking the cost benefits seriously, which the commission has done in the aftermath of the proxy access ruling, I think has been very important. And I think it provides a way to bring the principles of data and markets to bear in the regulatory process. I mean, I think if we're going to have effective regulation, it's important that it is subject to a serious cost-benefit test.
So let's go back to, we've sort of hit the end of your term and what the situation was there, but let's go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about some of the issues that you tackled.
Okay.
And how you tackled them from an economist's perspective.
Okay. So I'm gonna talk not only about market structure issues. So we'll talk in part about market structure issues, but we'll talk about other issues as well.
Yeah.
So I'll try to talk about some of the issues that I thought were among the most significant while I was there. You know, and they were in a variety of spaces. They were in the market structure space. They were, to some extent, with aspects of our assistance to the Division of Enforcement. They were to some degree also even in the accounting space, and particularly on option expensing. So let me talk about a variety of issues. So I think one issue which had already exploded before my arrival was the issue of mutual fund market timing.
Yeah.
And there the commission I think was arguably caught somewhat flat-footed, and they were kind of shown up by Attorney General Spitzer. Who happened to have a source. Now, you know, it's maybe not just luck that he had a source, because he was out there cultivating sources. But you know, then I think the commission, you know, once the issue was really squarely before the commission, and Attorney General Spitzer, I don't think there was any indication that he was really interested in reforming the markets. You know, he was interested in Attorney General Spitzer. But the commission, I think the commission was very slow. And this was well before I arrived. The commission was very slow to pick up on this mutual fund market timing thing. I think once it exploded, I think they did a very nice job of this. They looked systematically. They came up with a coherent framework for approaching these issues. And achieved serious sanctions, and sanctions that flowed under the relatively recent Sarbanes-Oxley Act. These sanctions basically resulted in fair funds that flowed back to the victims, mm-hmm. that flowed back to the, in effect, the uninformed investors who were being victimized. And I think that, you know, and so in a way it's perhaps the leading application, because there was so much money involved. There were, I think, literally billions of dollars of sanctions. It's the leading example of the fair funds being created under Sarbanes-Oxley. So here the sanctions went back to the victims, as opposed to the Treasury. So we work closely with the Division of Enforcement. I think my sense was they valued a lot what we did, because we had methods that allowed us to quantify the losses, And then we, you know, and so that was sort of so that was first at the stage where they were then the Division of Enforcement was negotiating settlements, and then we worked closely with them as well later when they were working with independent distribution consultants whose role was to distribute the money to the victims, and you know, I think in that context. My team and I worked closely with my team on these issues. I viewed these issues as very important, and I felt that I had a lot of it. I understood instinctively the nature of the misvaluations here and the option strategies that investors would follow. I understood deeply how stale pricing works and how that would be exploited. And so I worked closely with my team on these issues because I was able to help leverage them sort of further, but I had also a very skillful team.
How big was your team at this time? How big was your team?
Well, the overall group, the overall group for the whole economics group was like 30.
Okay.
And, you know, about 20 or so were PhDs, and several others were highly talented.
Did you create teams to deal with the different issues?
Well, on the issue, yeah. So we had a team that worked with the Division of Enforcement. So that was a small number of people. That might have been, you know, might have been half a dozen or so people. And, you know, sometimes we would bring somebody from another. If somebody had the right skills, we would kind of move them across and that sort of thing. But really, there were just a few people who worked closely who focused on these matters. There were a few people who focused on these matters, and they brought in others from time to time. But also that gave them a lot of expertise and a lot of knowledge. And, you know, being able to look across the different situations was very, very helpful. So later on, what our role was, so after a lot of the settlements were negotiated, then our role was to work with the independent distribution consultants who were being hired by the mutual funds with the SEC's concurrence. We worked with them as to how they would propose to distribute the money. Mm-hmm. Now, this points to kind of a little bit of a strange aspect. You know, these matters, you know, so most, and we participate, well, actually, let me back up. Let me say it slightly differently. So, and then we were working with many independent distribution consultants, and we worked closely, of course, with the Division of Enforcement. And then we, together with the Division of Enforcement, started to put these folks together a little bit because we felt that they could learn not only from us, but they could learn from each other's experiences. So we started to do these mega conference calls. Which I think was a very good device, and I worked closely on this with one of the deputy directors, Peter Bresnan, who was terrific. You know, and we sort of led for the commission. We led the efforts in this, and you know, and I think part of our strategy on this was to also have the independent distribution consultants hear each other's issues, problems, concerns, and this way they could kind of learn from each other, you know. And then, I think I played a useful role in this context because there were times as well where I would understand the concerns of, I certainly could understand the concerns of the Division of Enforcement because we were working closely with them, but I also understood the concerns of the independent distribution consultants, many of whom were finance professors, not all of whom, some were law professors, a few were retired judges, but the majority of whom were finance professors. And I could understand their concerns too, you know, especially when there would be things, or there would be aspects where they would be asked, certain kind of certifications they would be asked to provide. I mean, at some level they were well positioned to do, but at another level they really weren't so well positioned to do. And when they would express particular concerns, I sometimes was in a good position to be able to in effect explain that to translate, basically, but also in the other direction. When they were kind of focused on tangents or not really seeing what the Division of Enforcement felt was really important, sometimes I was able to kind of express it in their language too. Mm-hmm. So I was able to translate a little bit in both ways, and I thought that was sort of effective. And I thought it was effective that we were at times dealing with so many independent distribution consultants at the same time. And I don't mean just from the point of view that, okay, so we didn't have to have 20 separate conversations. So that was part of it. But also that they could learn from each other and they could, you know, because it wasn't like we were trying to kind of just cram stuff down. You know, Right. We wanted to try to sort out what was right. But so there's one aspect of this that's a little bit weird, that I had thought that maybe in my second year at the commission, when we had a lot of these calls, I thought a lot of the core business of how we would distribute this money was sort of being done. But I've had some independent distribution consultants complain to me that it took many, many years to get the money really out the door. And so there must be other aspects of this process that are not as simple, either not as simple or maybe at some point there's too much focus, there's not enough focus on really trying to get the money to the investors. And see, and the problem is, as the time adds, the problems become harder and harder. Look, the point is, you people who were the victims, how do you find them many years later? This was already starting to, it's a problem even a few years later. Well, as you increase the amount of time, it becomes more and more of a problem. It's not just that people move. They die, then there's this issue of the successors, and how do you track this? And you also, in these contexts, you had situations where, well, let me describe it this way. You know, here there weren't three victims who lost $5 million. Here there were a million victims who lost $150 million. Yeah. How do you distribute that? Well, many of the victims, they didn't lose the average. They lost a tiny fraction of the average because they had relatively modest investments with this particular fund. So what do you do then? What's a de minimis amount below which you're not going to send them the money? Now, meanwhile, the commission, of course, had concerns about, well, we don't want the money just flowing back into the fund. We want to send them, you know, there's legitimate issues about that. And so these are some of the kinds of issues that we had to sort of deal with and work through with respect to the mechanics. But also at the earlier stage, at the stage where we were helping the Division of Enforcement understand the magnitudes of the losses, we developed various methods. One of our preferred methods, although it was a little bit controversial, was the method called next day NAV. So the point was the particular price as of the end of the day, when these trades were happening, was biased. So our idea was to pick the following day's price as an unbiased measure. And it is an unbiased measure, I think. I don't think there's much ambiguity about that, at least in most of the relevant context. But it's a noisy measure. And that's where I think a lot of the concerns from outside counsel and the mutual funds came about. You know, and so, you know, and sometimes they had legitimate points about that, about, you know, so we tried to sharpen it up at times in different ways. But we tried to basically, you know, we tried to use this sort of, this I think it was a good framework, but also, you know, over time I think we also learned about its limitations, and, you know, and,
but you had to start somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it was a good place. Not only was it a good place, it was a uniform way to start, but because it was noisy, it was a noisy, you know. And sometimes I think the negotiated, and obviously we weren't really involved in the negotiations. You know, the Division of Enforcement would seek our input, and then they would negotiate the settlement. And on the one hand, I think they tried to adhere to this metric, but, you know, the metric worked better in some cases than it did in other cases, and I think sometimes the settlements then reflected that.
You talked about sort of sticking to late trading and market timing.
Yep.
You already talked about the governance rules, some of the rulemaking that followed. One of the things that's interesting to me is the idea of the redemption fees.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the whole point of a mutual fund is the ability to get in and get out. And is that something that came across your desk?
Well, a little bit. So the redemption fees, this was more of a So this was more of an issue. The redemption fees were more of an issue from the point of view of a proposed regulation of the commission, and the commission wanted to encourage the use of redemption fees, and the redemption fees would go back into the product. The way I recall it, I think the redemption fees were going to go back into the product. So I've sometimes used this. So I've been, since in the aftermath of that, I've been teaching financial regulation to our MBA students, and in the last few years also to our undergraduates. And I think at some point I actually wrote a little exam question about this kind of issue, a 2%, that if you had a 2% sanction, not sanction, 2% fee, would this cut off the trading? And I think the point of my question was basically, if you get out, it depends on what the timing is. If you could get out of the 2% fee by holding on for 5 days, it's not such a big deal, because let's say you have a 0.75% or 1% or a 2% advantage, and you go in. Well, then you're just stuck being in the product for 5 days. Okay, and then you go out. And then you go out when, obviously you only go out when it's optimal to go out. You kind of time when you go in, you time when you go out. On the other hand, if you're stuck in the product for 6 months, that's different. So I think it is dependent a lot on the timing. On the other hand, it also gets in the way of legitimate stuff. Let me give you an example of a simple trading strategy, which I think is highly appropriate for investors, and that's a tax loss taking strategy. Okay. So it's very appropriate for investors to take tax losses. And even if they want to take them in a couple of weeks, whatever investors want to do, this is permitted under the tax code, subject to the wash sale rule. But investors can sell, for example, a fund, and basically buy another fund, maybe in a not necessarily that's doing exactly the same thing, but in a somewhat different space. So the point is, If you have to stay in a fund, let's say 6 months, and otherwise you're going to pay 2%, that fund, I think, is non-competitive, because you're basically telling your investors you can't take those tax, the initial tax losses. And after a while, there's not going to be any tax losses, because eventually prices are going to move up. And so the point is, you want to when you first establish positions, you want to have the flexibility to take your losses. And if the product design gets in the way of that, that seems to me bizarre.
Was that were those
that issue that tag, that point wasn't really so much on the table? But I think, but I do think like a 2% rule over a really short horizon, like 5 days, yeah. I don't think that would discourage the market timer so much.
Yeah.
If it was for 6 months, it would. But it has then this other problem.
Right. So, but there was no great consideration of that. I mean, it seems like it was just something that
it was sort
things
of,
needed to be done.
Yeah. So that's right. I think that's sort of a way to summarize it. But maybe we move on to some other.
Yeah, that would be great. I know you spent a lot of time in options expense.
Yeah. So option expensing. So we work closely with the Office of the Chief Accountant on this, and I think this is an area where we had a lot of technical expertise. We understood the option pricing models. We understood their strengths. We understood their limitations. I think we were able to vet the claims being made by the tech community. At one point I was at a meeting, and a senior person from a high profile tech company, like a CFO type person, declared, if you require option expensing, our stock price is going to fall by a third. And I said, explain that to me. And they said, well, our earnings are going to fall by a third, so our stock price is going to fall by a third. I must say, I thought that was really quite disingenuous.
Hmm.
Why? Because the assumption that he was making was that the PE multiple for his stock falls from the sky, and it's the same no matter what the accounting rule. This doesn't really reflect how markets work. Now, maybe they were trying to confuse their board or others about what the cost of the options were, But this was sort of bizarre. But this was the type of stuff that was sort of out there. And ultimately what happened, I think, is striking. You know, I arrived at the latter stages of the debate about option expensing, by the way. There already had been almost 10 years of debate. And at this point, it was close to a done deal, basically. The FASB was largely moving forward. There was a lot of controversy in D.C. There wasn't really controversy at the White House, by the way. I know that for sure. But there was a lot of controversy. But, you know, the White House, it wasn't really a White House issue, so they weren't involved. I think they were obviously happy not to be involved with so much controversy on the outside. Right. But the Congress, they were still kind of engaged, but even they were kind of pulling back. I think partially because after the Sarbanes-Oxley kind of issues and all those accounting scandals, I think the Congress started to become more and more reluctant to kind of do the tech companies bidding on this issue. But it's, you know, what happened subsequently? So did innovation in America collapse? Hardly. Did people become less interested in working for Silicon Valley companies? Hardly. Just the opposite. Not directly causal.
Right.
But what did the companies do? Actually, what they did was they did pull back on the use of option expensing because they no longer because option expensing no longer had a special place in the accounting rules. So they started using things like restricted stock. You know, so basically, I think what the purpose of option expensing was to try to create, you know, was the approaches that were used in option expensing perfect? No. But the notion was that the costs weren't zero. Now, sometimes there were also proposals being made that we should use market-based approaches to option expensing, and my group was heavily involved in vetting these. There were a couple of proposals that got visibility, and without commenting specifically on the particular proposals, so at some point I made a speech. It was an interesting little speech, and I said that it was important that, and it actually got. It was the only time one of my speeches got. My speeches were all on the SEC website. They're still on the SEC website. They were on my Carnegie website, too. But because the only time my speech, I think, got picked up, it got picked up in the Wall Street Journal. And I said that it's important that market-based approaches be properly designed. And so I get this call from somebody who read, from a now prominent journalist who was then covering us when she was more junior, and she said, "So Chester, I read your speech. It was very interesting." I said, "Okay." We said, "Well, I'm going to go with the story unless you tell me it's wrong." I said, "Well, what's your story say?" SEC, and then the headline was something like SEC top economist expresses concern about Cisco proposal. So I said, I didn't say anything in my speech about a Cisco proposal. In fact, you know, there was no public, I mean, except the New York Times had already broken the story about the Cisco proposal a month before.
There was the assumption that you were...
Yeah. But, and as I said, well, you know, I'm expressing concern that it's important that these be properly designed. But, you know, ultimately she said, well, if you tell me it's wrong, I won't run it. I said, well, I can't. I said, my point is that it's important that these be properly designed. I can't tell you it's wrong.
Yeah.
She ran the story. Okay. But then I started getting bad mouth on the Hill. That was kind of interesting. That's the only time anybody on the Hill ever heard of me. That was kind of
interesting. Well, that's what the Wall Street Journal will do.
Yeah. No, exactly. Well, some of the folks in the industry thought that the purpose was they wanted to use market-based approaches because they were going to design the structure so they were going to generate a low number. Now, that's not the point. The point is you're trying to get an estimate of the cost of the company and a legitimate estimate of the cost of the company. So sometimes what people would do is they would create a market structure such that the number would come out low, or that they envisioned that the market would come out low, or they would design some other instrument where the valuation number would be low. And, you know, this was just an attempt it's kind of like a cheat, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that reflected kind of what our attitude was. Now, I think at some point the attitude in the commission was evolving in this space, and so we weren't always the one.
In what way was it?
Well, I think, you know, some of the leadership, I think, you know, there was some, because there was a, you know, there was, I think in the, there was a change in the chief accountant's office, and so, you know, and ultimately they were the ones who had the key, had the most important input on the issue. But I think option expensing is an issue we contributed a lot, both especially on the implementation phase, and I think also in the initial vetting of market-based approaches. Although then the issue of market-based approaches basically faded. Why? Because I think the tech community got it, that there wasn't a level playing field before, and then they figured out, how do we want to compensate people? Given that there's going to be a level playing field, how do we want to compensate people? So that's what they did. Then there were other issues that kind of came up, too, in the option vein. I probably shouldn't take as much time on it, but option backdating. Option backdating, in some ways, was a lot like market timing, except there was more explicit fraud. So in option backdating, I think the leadership at some companies, they were actually backdating the documents. And it became obvious that this was what was happening, because you could see the footprints in the data. The only way you could explain some of the patterns in the data cross-sectionally was if they were falsifying the dates in certain ways. Because what happened, what tended to happen was that the dates you would see would be like the best possible dates over some big interval of time. And so you kind of knew that they were looking back and they were picking those dates off. You could see the empirical footprints. In fact, one of my staff members, so the option backdating was generated on the outside, was identified on the outside by an academic named Eric Lee. And then the Wall Street Journal started covering this, and it kind of really blossomed out there. And then the commission got heavily involved. Well, then one of my staff members who was working with the Division of Enforcement, a fellow by the name of David Cicero, who's now an academic, he looked at the exercises. So the option backdating was about the grants. My staff member looked at the exercises, in part because I think he saw some evidence in a couple of situations with the Division of Enforcement, and he knew that the exercises were backdated too. So he thought, oh, let's look for patterns. Let's look in the cross-section. And he had a very clever way. And academics had already, in effect, been looking, sort of, but they were looking through the wrong lens. And what my staff member had the cleverness to figure out was that what the incentives were, the detailed incentives, were different if the stock was being sold back to the company in the exercise, or if they were being retained by the executive. And it was the opposite incentive, basically, whether you wanted a high price or a low price. Mm-hmm. And so what you saw in the data was one pattern when they wanted a low price, and one pattern when they wanted a high price. They always got their wish, it seemed. And so you see these effects, and that basically was the clue that yes, indeed, in the cross section, there was a lot of exercise backdating. Hmm. Now, you know, some of this I always thought was kind of weird, that there were so many companies doing it. The mutual fund market timing I understood much better. First of all, I kind of understood it instinctively because I realized that there were stale prices, and then I thought a lot of people knew that there were stale prices, and so then the fact that people would come up with schemes to exploit that. Not so surprising, and that some of the schemes might come from the outside, some of it might come from insiders, you know, maybe all of that not so surprising. And there were different kinds of mutual fund market timing cases, by the way. Sometimes it was just because the company didn't follow the policies it stated, sometimes it's because its people were complicit, sometimes the fund was a victim of some broker who was defrauding it by sending them back timestamp, by misstating the timestamps, almost very much like backdating of the option. So there were different kind of scenarios, but in the backdating, you know, this wasn't something that was really kind of out there. And then you wondered, how could it be that so many companies did this? How did they all know? Well, I think there clearly must have been some sort of communication channels. I don't think this has really been so clearly sorted out. Hmm. But I've always sort of imagined that it either might have been some compensation consultants, or might have been some board members, although the board members, you know, they weren't on so many boards.
Right.
Or it could be some outside counsels, But I'm not sure. Again, there might be more ability to operate across companies there. But again, they wouldn't be so involved with so many companies. But anyway, you know, but interesting that it kind of permeated across so many companies before anybody knew about it.
Yeah.
By the way, the whole problem went away with Sarbanes-Oxley. I think this was one of the best aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley, actually. So there were aspects of it which were maybe sort of more mixed, or with a lot of costs that were created by Sarbanes-Oxley, like the 404 certifications and the like. But one aspect that was very good was the companies were told, you have to file your reports on option grants, on option exercises, on insider trading. You've got to file these in 2 days, not in 6 months or 3 months or whatever people were doing. And so Sarbanes-Oxley just put that into effect without knowing this problem. And you know what? So when you look at that data afterwards, the problem went away.
Huh.
So all this evidence was from before, and then the problem went away. So this is actually an aspect of Sarbanes-Oxley I think was sort of unambiguously to the good. And it was, and I don't know that anybody even knew that it would accomplish this. I think they were just sort of looking for more timely reports. But they didn't realize how bogus some of the reports were.
Compensation disclosure, too. That's part of this set of issues, right?
Yeah. So executive comp, so gradually, you know, the SEC, you know, has pushed to try to get more and more disclosure. It's a tough, in a way, it's sort of a tough issue. I think disclosure of executive comp is important. I think there was a fair amount of political consensus in Washington in the period I was at the commission for more disclosure of executive compensation. But I think it's important to keep in mind, this doesn't necessarily... One of the things I pointed out in some of my speeches in this area was more disclosure doesn't necessarily mean lower comp. Now, people were kind of surprised when I said things like that. But why is that? Well, what does more disclosure do? So on the one hand, if there's basically an agency problem and the executives are just kind of doing stuff they shouldn't be doing and they're getting lots of comp, the disclosure maybe would be helpful and would push the board to scale back the comp. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, so to speak. On the other hand, suppose by disclosing people's compensation, their reaction is, well, This job is less attractive than my alternatives, like working for a private equity fund. So now I need to be compensated more. Adam Smith talked about that. It was called a compensating differential. So that goes in the opposite direction. Then finally, you know, so that's why it's not so clear. That's why I pointed this out in at least one of my speeches, maybe multiple ones. And also, how does it change the bargaining process? Well, that's, I think, an interesting facet, too. Does it allow the executive to bargain better, or does it allow the company to bargain better? Now, that's not about the particular company's comp. That's about what the other comps are.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now, you know, in principle, maybe it shouldn't matter because everybody's armed to the teeth in these negotiations with the compensation consultants. But you know, I bet it does. I bet it might have some effects there, but those effects were also ambiguous. So anyway, that's sort of my take. It's a little bit of an idiosyncratic take on compensation disclosure. My personal view is that some of the more recent things have probably gone too far. So the Dodd-Frank required this pay ratio disclosure, and I was pretty persuaded by Commissioner and actually currently, although maybe for only another few minutes, acting chair Peewar's criticism that this was very costly, not relevant to investors. You know, it did seem to me like this pay ratio disclosure, there would be a lot of costs, and this wouldn't really be helpful to investors. It seemed to me kind of maybe more political. Unfortunately, more political.
There's one other topic that I wanted to get to, which was Reg Show.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk. I definitely want to talk about that, and then also want to talk about NMS and also people I worked with.
Definitely. I want to save the market stuff for last.
That's good. I think on the other issues, I guess we got to cost benefit. Yeah. Okay. We've done cost benefit. We did mutual fund option, expensing option back then. Good. Yeah. Anyway.
So rate show, that's short sales. And you're looking, essentially, you're looking at how to implement this or how to structure the rulemaking? Is that what?
Well, so a few things happened. So there were a couple aspects of Reg Show, and the one aspect was there were a lot of complaints that delivery wasn't happening, that there were fails to deliver. Now, the biggest source of the complaints were from small companies who felt they were being taken down by short sellers. That was the source of the complaints, I would say. And the SEC, and I guess they were able to rev up a lot of letters, and I think the SEC leadership, you know, I think felt like it needed to tighten up a bit on this issue of delivery. And so they tightened the delivery requirements, basically said that if you didn't deliver in a certain amount of time, while you would have some extensions, you would get bought back in. Then the SEC came up with a locate requirement. And that was, I think, one of the big changes. The locate requirement was that when the broker sells the stock short, he's got to locate the stock he can borrow. Now, this was not what they would call a hard locate. It was not a hard locate. It was not a hard. So you didn't actually have to make the deal. You didn't actually have to borrow the stock before you did the short. Now, but people would say to me, oh, well, wouldn't the locate be enough? And I think the locate was probably sensible if you felt like that people shouldn't be able to sell stock short without basically borrowing it. But why could there be some wiggle room? Well, because you do a locate, so one broker calls another and he locates the stuff, but five different brokers are calling that same one and they locate the stuff. And then, so nobody's lying, but then, and then one of them claims the stock, and then when the others go to the stock, they don't have the stock anymore. So the problem with a hard one would be the reverse. The problem with a hard one, with a hard locate, is if you first had to make the deal, well, maybe you didn't. In the end, you didn't want to sell the stock, and this is going to seem like it imposes a lot of friction on the markets. So that seems like needless. That seems needless. So there was some controversy at the time about what the lines were.
Right.
So at some point later on, and actually in October 2008, so right at the heart of the crisis, I'm not in the media so much, but I got called by Fox Business. They wanted to do a little point counterpoint, and they had, I think it was one of the Patrick Byrne Sr. from Overstock, and it was about the short sale issue, but it was clear we were talking in disconnected kind of ways, because I felt, I mean, he was focusing on companies like theirs, Overstock, and where there were, you know, there's issues about liquidity in the shorting process, and I thought the contemporaneous issues were about the big banks, because this was right after the commission had banned short sales on the 900 financial stocks. So I thought the issues were about these banks, where there wasn't really a mechanical problem with shorting and borrowing the stock. This was like a non-issue. So we were a little bit at cross purposes on that. So the delivery was one aspect on the short sale piece. So another key aspect, by the way, another key aspect that I was involved in was the short sale pilot,
right,
the uptick pilot. So basically taking off the 70-year-old requirement that you could only sell stock on a rising tick, that you couldn't do it on a declining tick. And we were very favorable to that. My predecessor had started the process for the pilot. We implemented the pilot. And at some point late on in the implementation, we had an academic roundtable, and it was very clear Floyd Norris from the Times came down. I think he wrote a column about it. But it was very clear there wasn't any disagreement about this. And then within the next 6 to 9 months, the commission moved forward to repeal this. Well, later on, what we did as part of the transition to this, we did this natural experiment. It was a beautiful natural experiment. We took off the restriction on 1,000 of the Russell 3000 stocks, and we did sort of a nice match sample. We did like a match sample kind of approach. And, you know, I think it was a very nice approach, and we kind of basically saw what would happen. Well, later on, this became controversial because there were some people who thought, mistakenly in my view, that this was at the roots of the financial crisis.
Right.
One of them is very high profile. A couple of them were very high profile. One is named Jim Cramer. Another, and he talked about this repeatedly on his show. And another was named John McCain, who went crazy about this in the middle of September of 2008. And at some point he called for Chris Cox's head because Chris had signed off on this issue. The Wall Street Journal actually had a rejoinder on this. They wrote a very nice editorial. They basically said that the work that my group did on the repeal of this was the best economically vetted work out of the SEC in a long, long time.
Hmm. And this is the pilot project.
This was on the pilot, yeah. You know, and they wrote this editorial. It was a very nice editorial. They wrote this editorial in September of 2008. And it was clearly a rejoinder to McCain. Now, they saved up. They had one more editorial in mind. A week later, they wrote a second editorial. The second editorial was to be highly critical of the SEC for banning the short sales on the 900 financial stocks. But they did a very clever job, I thought, of separating the two things.
Huh.
And that, I think, was very nice. I thought that was very nice. Because the first one, they praised the commission and very critical of McCain for calling for Chris Cox's head. And then the second one, they kind of made it clear that the SEC was a little bit confused, too. But the SEC had a problem, as why I understand. Now, I wasn't at the commission when the SEC did that ban. The way I understood it is that the White House, and potentially at the highest levels, were calling the commission to really push on this idea of the ban.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think most academics think it's kind of bizarre that you ban short sales in the face of bad information. Now, why is that? Well, I think for a lot of reasons. It's bizarre. And by the way, Chris Cox, to his credit, when he did basically an exit interview, so to speak, with the Washington Post at the end of the year, at the end of that year, and he said, they asked him what was the worst mistake he made during the crisis, and he said it was listening to his colleagues on the president's working group and agreeing to ban the short sales on those 900 financial stocks.
Hmm.
Now, that said a couple of things, by the way, obviously. It's saying that the policy decision was wrong and that maybe his colleagues on the president's working group didn't know as much as what they thought about his space. And I think that was a very principled thing for Chris to say. Why do I think this was such bad policy? Because basically you have a situation where you've now kind of made your whole regulatory structure uncertain in terms of how it's going to operate in the future. That's a huge issue, a huge cost. Furthermore, in the midst of the crisis, what are you telling investors? You're telling investors, however bad you think things are, they're even worse than you thought. So we're banning these short sales. So what was the market's reaction? It wasn't good. It was bad. Furthermore, the option market makers, they immediately went to market regulation, and they said, well, you know, if we can't short sell, we can't hedge, which means we can't make option markets. So we're going to close down. And then the staff said, well, no, we don't want you to close down. So the commission agreed to exempt them. Mm-hmm. I think that was the right thing to do, given that they were going to ban these short sales, but it points to the problem. How the heck do you set up a regulation and then you exempt this one category and give them monopoly power? That's not what the SEC should build. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was the right response, given the other aspects of it.
Right.
Because otherwise then we wouldn't have had option markets either. And this surely would have been problematic. It would have been more problematic. The commission understood that. But, you know, in principle, you don't kind of exempt somebody from something so basic like that and give them monopoly power. This is not what we want to do as regulators. So anyway, that's my take on short sales.
I think the pilot project is very interesting.
Yeah, so on the pilot. So we did this natural experiment. So there is one thing I learned later. So that natural experiment, it was very good. And, you know, it's unseated a whole bunch of pilots. The SEC is like now in the pilot business.
Oh, okay.
I think some folks at the SEC, well, partially because the Congress has really even pushed them, sometimes some of the pilots, I think, have not so well conceived. Some of them are well conceived. I'm a fan of the make-or-take pilot, but then again, I'm on the SEC's Equity Market Structure Advisory Committee, which recommended this, because I think the make-or-take structure is a big mess, basically. And I think there's all kinds of incentive problems that it creates. And I think this is a step to try to help sort that out. But where the Congress really pushed the SEC was on the tick size pilot. But I think there was very strong evidence as to what tick sizes would do. As if you change the tick size, what would be the effects? I don't think we needed a pilot to do this. I don't think we needed to muck around with the markets to do that. Because I think there was a lot of evidence that and we had evidence of what happened in the other way. Now, the Congress had the idea, somebody created the idea, that there would be more IPOs in America if only the analysts made a little bit more money. I don't think this is the main margin on which IPOs are being decided. I think part of it may be. Now, maybe the costs of being a public company are too big. Maybe that plays into it. But it's not specifically about the analysts and the tick. And furthermore, could a pilot possibly produce enough data to help you sort out, would there be more IPOs if we just had a little bit wider tick? There's no way there's going to be enough statistical power on that. So
interesting.
So that. One last point about the short sales. So one thing I learned later, also, is that the pilots aren't perfect. So I'm still a big fan of pilots, but they're not perfect because some of the things don't show up. They're not perfect in the sense some of the things don't show up in the pilot. For example, there are some things that are spillover effects. And Charles Jones at Columbia, with some collaborators, has done some very nice work on documenting this. So it turns out when the thing went live, things were even a little bit stronger, than they would have been suggested from the pilot when it actually went live later on. And the reason was because in the pilot, you could only sell a third of the stock short. So if you were going to do program trades against the futures, well, you wouldn't do that because you wouldn't be able to sell short two-thirds of the stocks. But when the thing went live, you could do that. So there were some things there were spillover effects that you couldn't pick up in the one context that would arise naturally later.
Yeah.
So I don't think pilots are perfect, but I think they're still a really good tool.
Let's get to the NMS.
Absolutely.
Now this is something that's moving when you arrive, right?
It was already sort of moving. It was partially on hold, but partially moving. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was really conceived before. It was definitely conceived before. It was, partially conceived, I think, by my predecessor, Larry Harris, partially conceived by Annette Nazareth, who was, of course, at the time, the director of market regulation, who subsequently became commissioner. You know, so I sort of came in, and the NMS was sort of moving.
Was it in common at that point?
I think it might have been in between. I don't remember, but I think it might have been in between. But I certainly remember there was a very interesting meeting I was at with some of the most important people at the commission on this issue. Mm-hmm. And I raised an issue that had a huge impact on the way that which the process played out. I raised the following issue. I said, look, this rule, it's going to protect the tops of the book, but not protect anywhere down. So we're really not protecting the best prices. We're protecting the best price at an individual platform, but not the best X prices in the market, because some platform, it might have three other prices right below that are still better than everybody else's prices, right. And we're not protecting those. We're just protecting at the tops. So I pointed out that basically this was really not intellectually consistent, and so I think given that, I think the leadership thought, okay, well, let's explore this a little bit more. So they put out for comment two variations, going all the way down, and the the more basic one, protecting the top,
mm-hmm.
which had been the original proposal.
Right.
Well, people went crazy. And by the way, they never outed me either. The leadership really deserves a lot of credit because they could have really made me to be the fall guy on this because.
So they put this out that they were going to protect more orders.
They were going to protect all the way down.
All the way down.
As a variation. Okay. And this is an alternative. We're considering this alternative too. And people went crazy.
Why?
Because this was. So NMS was already criticized as being prescriptive, which it is. And I think that is one of the criticisms of it. From my perspective today, that's the main criticism, one of the main criticisms of NMS. But it's not just the problem with it. Protecting all this stuff would have been even much more prescriptive. Now, it was very interesting also, some of the players explicitly weighed in for the one alternative versus the other. And this is, I think, what really was sort of fascinating, how it influenced the debate. So one of the things I noticed in the comments, as I was looking at the comments, we got a lot of letters from members of Congress.
Hmm.
And the letters invariably supported the one version, but not the other version, not the one going all the way down. There was lots of opposition to going all the way down. Now, part of the opposition was it was very prescriptive, way too prescriptive, I think probably fairly so. But why was there so many letters from members of Congress? Well, the New York Stock Exchange had hired somebody with a tremendous Washington expertise in the communications, like a former press secretary type, to guide them. And this person, they engaged with the members of Congress, and they got a lot of their members wrote a lot of short letters that made clear. A, not B. Boom, boom, boom. You got all these. You know, you could kind of see this. But I don't know what the impact of the letter. But the fact that everybody was really concerned that it was too prescriptive and that it was going to be too costly, that way too, far more costly than the other to implement. I don't know if it would have been so much more costly. But in any case, so the commission didn't go that route. And they got a lot of criticism because they put this alternative out there. A lot of people thought that they put the alternative out there because they wanted to make their proposal have smooth sailing. So by having something that was so draconian, people thought, oh, they were being wise guys. They're putting this draconian thing out there, so they're going to get what they want to get done.
Yeah.
But I think actually the reason they put the draconian thing out there is I pointed to the intellectual inconsistency in the other. And they, to their credit, they never outed me on this, because you could kind of imagine. Yeah, anyway.
In a way, they're not protecting sort of the best price.
You're not, they're exactly.
They're protecting the competition.
Exactly. The best the individual best price at the competition.
Right. So but keeping, sort of ensuring that there's going to be a lot of players out there.
So one of the things I've been pointing out in the last few years, really starting with my congressional testimony. I testified before the relevant subcommittee of the House Financial Services Committee at the end of February of 14. And now this is also reflected in my main talk in this area, which I should send along to you, that this really promotes the form of the NMS, really promotes fragmentation or proliferation. One way to think about that is if the top price you're quoting is protected, and if protection is valuable, then what you want to do is you want to subdivide. You want to have a bunch of different entities, and each one's top price would be protected. So in effect, you could imagine in the limit, you could achieve the other solution just by kind of splitting things up. So in a way, NMS provides a direct regulatory incentive for fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I started to realize. Maybe a different way to sort of frame the issue, and I started sort of reflecting that theme in part with that congressional testimony, and also in my current paper in this space, and even in some of the conversations in other contexts too. Also, part of the reason NMS, by the way, it's not clear to me that fragmentation is bad. There's another term for fragmentation. It's called competition. and I'll say it in a form where I think it's unambiguously good. One of the things that NMS led to was the demise of the New York Stock Exchange specialist. I think with hindsight, that structure was pretty much indefensible. This was basically a system where there was tremendous market power, and we didn't really need to have this market power. No reason to have the, you know, and you could see the market power in various forms. You could see it in the value of the seats. You could even sell it, you could even see it to the extent when you walked around the floor, you noticed that many of these businesses were family businesses. Now, when I go see my lawyer, or when I go see my doctor, most of those practices, they don't have any relatives in them. Now, some people would say, well, because they have anti-nepotism rules. But even putting that aside, you know, often children, they go into other endeavors. The specialists, their kids often went into the business. Why was that? I think it was because once you kind of got the basic skill, you know, basically, it was a business where there were a lot of rents being earned. And it would otherwise ultimately be hard to transfer the rents because you couldn't really sell the... It would be hard to just capitalize the rents. So instead, you pass them down. You know, so but I think also the seat values are kind of a personification of this. Right. Now, ultimately, the Stock Exchange came out with a very clever solution to the problem of the specialists and the seats. They quickly, after NMS, they merged with Archipelago. And that provided... That solved a number of problems. That provided liquidity to the stock exchange, so they could basically buy out the specialist, and you know, and so the specialist would say, "Well, thank you very much," because now all of a sudden they could liquefy. It also provided an interesting regulatory solution to them. Imagine in that era if they had gone to the SEC and they said, "Oh, we want to become a public company." What machinations would the SEC have put them through? But instead, here in the aftermath of NMS, they're going to merge with an existing public company. Well, of course, they're going to have that governance structure. So it's shortcutted a lot of the regulatory process that would have probably been very complicated and awkward otherwise. So I thought this was sort of very clever in the direct aftermath of NMS. Kind of coming back to the issue of proliferation, one of the things that NMS did was it pushed very strongly... what you have to do in executing is you have to get the best price on the next piece of the order. That is, you have to look around and you can't just kind of do some big package. You've got to respect those prices. Well, not all the way down, but still you've got to respect at the top.
Right.
Okay. Well, actually, the institutional investors, they don't like this. Why don't they like it? Because it gets in the way of their flexibility. And they're concerned, no, if they take out 300 shares here and 500 shares there, people are going to figure out they got X zillion shares behind that. And what's going to happen? The prices are going to move adversely. Which, by the way, indirectly is the complaint in Michael Lewis's book. But he doesn't interpret it this way.
I want to get to that.
Yeah, but he, you know, but actually some of Michael Lewis's complaints are actually indirectly about NMS and about some of the, and in a way you can sort of see how this kind of, you know, in a way sort of fits together. NMS pushes that you fill in small pieces. It encourages proliferation of platforms. So all of this is fragmentation. By the way, why did also the specialists also disappear? Well, there was another reason they disappeared. They wouldn't have been viable under NMS anyway. Why? Because you had to be a fast market. You can't have significant manual markets and meet the fast market requirements. So basically, the specialists were toast once NMS was adopted. And then the stock exchange, incredibly quickly, within like weeks, they had this really elegant solution, namely the acquisition by Archipelago. But I think, actually, the most important impact of NMS, in my mind, was the demise of the specialist system. And I think that was an incredibly good... just like the NASDAQ became so much more competitive in the aftermath of its scandal a decade before, I think this really improved dramatically our market structure in the rest of the space.
Were there any of the fallout or any of the repercussions of NMS that you dealt with while you were?
Not so much, because the implementation took a couple of years, so we were just involved in implementing.
Right.
And some of my perspectives they've kind of only, they've taken me time to form, too. And, you know, so partially in preparing for my congressional testimony a few years ago, my service on the Equity Market Structure Advisory Committee, also this talk that I'm, this which has been like a keynote address that I've given a half a dozen times over the last year or so in this space. Also, I was involved, okay, and one other way in which my perspectives also started to form, I was involved, initially put together basically by Knight Securities, the old Knight Securities. I did a little project with Larry Harris and Jim Angel that's gotten a fair bit of attention. And actually, then we had a little follow-on to it, too, and that's gotten some attention as well. What these studies basically did is they looked at, so how have spreads changed, basically, in the aftermath of NMS? And then we also opined a bit on what did we see as some of the current regulatory, well, this is several years ago, but what did we see then as some of the current regulatory issues and challenges? And that was helpful in a number of ways to me. One way it was helpful was I observed, we have some very nice plots that people are using over and over in all kinds of presentations these days about what happened to spreads, what happened to market share, NYSE market share went from 80% to 20% on its listed stocks, what happened to spreads, spreads declined dramatically. Now, it still leaves open largely the question of, well, what about institutional trading costs? See, institutional trading costs, the institutions are not so happy about NMS, and this is important, I think, because you know because they're not just investing for the wealthy people, maybe hardly for the wealthy, but they're really investing for America, for America's public, because you know that's that you know they're you know these mutual funds that's who they're investing for. I think the big asset managers, they're concerned about their flexibility in the trading process, and that NMS kind of gets in the way of that. And I really do see that as tied in a little bit to some of the issues in the Michael Lewis book. Maybe not. Obviously, he's talking in part about other issues, too, and IEX and the like.
How so? Because I think the publication you talk about did get a lot of
tremendous
coverage. It's like the first thing I ran across, and I just kept running across it.
Absolutely. And it led, for example, to the formation of our equity structure advisory. It's pretty clear it led to the formation of our equity structure advisory committee.
In the
for
SEC.
Example.
It's a pretty positive picture. I mean, you know, more liquidity, more trading, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you reconcile that with some of the more negative portrayals that you get? And then you've just talked about Michael Lewis, who's sort of...
I'm sorry.
There's a general negative approach to the speed of the markets, the fact that the markets are
okay. So the markets are clearly
the average.
Okay. Yeah. So the markets are clearly faster. And one of the criticisms of that is that there's a lot of costs that are incurred to make it faster. I joke to my students at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Well, why should we complain that somebody wants to spend $300 million drilling through the Allegheny Mountains nearby here? Maybe we should consider that public works. But the point basically is okay. So. I mean, clearly, the willingness to invest a lot of resources to get a tiny advantage, that clearly says there's rents being earned in the business. And so there's some competition that dissipates some of the rents. Now, do I always understand what advertising is good for? No. And some advertising, I think, is kind of baloney. You hear some of these pharmaceutical commercials, and... Well, apparently there's some regulatory requirement that they have to disclose that their side effects.
Right.
So they pick the worst. They pick the most bizarre side effects, basically, so people think that won't happen to them, because in fact they've cast them in such a bizarre way, and as a way to kind of be dismissive of the side effects. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So do I think those commercials serve a lot of good? I don't think so, because I think. You know, how should you decide what kind of medicines you're going to use? You should talk to your doctor. Now they say that in the commercials too, but what's the value of those commercials? Now I'm not so sure it's so great. But obviously, there's a lot of rents that the drug companies are earning. That's why they run those commercials. Now, so what should we do in this space? And so now people talk. There's an arms race.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the term that they use. Okay, well, was there an arms race 50 years ago? Yeah. You know how the New York Stock Exchange did it? New York Stock Exchange used to not allow cell phones on the floor. They were very proud of this in some of my visits going back 15, 20 years, that they didn't allow cell phones on the floor. Why didn't those guys allow cell phones on the floor? Because they rented out the space around the edge, and that's where you could communicate. But if they allowed you to have a cell phone, who would need that space? So they were competing with the phone company, basically. And then giving you a landline over at the side rather than allowing you to use a cell phone. So this is how they were capturing the rents. So there was co-location then. I mean, people talk about co-location now as if it got discovered last week. Well, not last week, but that it got discovered maybe in Michael Lewis's book or whatever, or in the last 5 years. No. And did people sometimes get an edge out of the Pony Express or out of the Telegraph? Absolutely. And 400 years ago, when the boats would come in to Europe, were people observing how far down in the water were the boats and drawing inferences from that? Right. Absolutely. So is getting the relative time advantage a new thing? No. So now it's occurring over smaller and smaller units of time. Sure. Now, so the question is, at some point, do we want to impose? Well, you know, I'm not sure. Now, there is the physical issue, right? Because we know at some point there's the physical limitation, the speed of light stuff.
It.
Okay. But, you know, still, I'm not... This issue I don't think is so clear-cut. And I think people haven't really cast it enough in a historical context, and that it's about relative time. And maybe another way I would say it is, we know that in asset markets, a lot of the volatility is not from the natural, it's not just the natural information, it's from the trading. The trading is how information gets produced and aggregated. There's a classic study in finance published in the mid-1980s by two famous researchers, Richard Roll and Ken French. In this paper, they looked at an interesting example. They looked at the example of the New York Stock Exchange in the late 1960s. I think in 1968, the Stock Exchange was closed on, I think, roughly 18 Wednesdays. Now, why did the Stock Exchange close? Because they couldn't deal with the back office aspects of clearing 10 or 20 million shares a day. Now, so what did they do? Well, first they slimmed the hours, so they closed at 2 o'clock. But that wasn't enough. So then they closed on Wednesdays to give them time to catch up. Okay, so what did French and Roll do with this? So they looked both within that sample and then also for days where the stock exchange was open, they looked at the volatility. And what did they find? Basically, the volatility really was associated with the market being open, with the trading. Mm. And I think that really speaks strongly to that if you speed up the clock, you're affecting... It's not just there's a cost issue on the one side. So the critics on this issue, and I don't have a strong view, but I think that a lot of the criticisms, they focus on the cost and not acknowledging that there's a benefit. But I do think there is a cost-benefit trade-off.
Okay. Anything else we should talk about?
But not too many things. So just a couple of other observations. So I think one issue we weren't so heavily involved in, but I think it's an important one from an economic perspective, has to do with sanctions. And I think maybe hasn't gotten so much attention. Now, when I was at the commission, there was a little bit of attention to this, but we weren't No, nobody was really interested in our being players on this. It's sort of fair to say.
The lawyers, like,
yeah. Well, the commissioners on the one, or certain commissioners on the one hand, and the enforcement division on the other. So the issue of corporate sanctions has sometimes been controversial. The reason it's controversial is because the victims, in some of these matters, the victims are the stockholders. That's when they're controversial. If the victims are somebody else, then it's not so controversial. So if Goldman Sachs, if they are alleged to defraud some other company, there's not so much criticism about whether there should be a corporate sanction. But suppose it was an accounting fraud, and the victims were the own stockholders. then should you sanction those stockholders too? They already lost in the stock price right. because of the... And I think this is a legitimate issue. Now, you know, Chris Cox really pushed on this issue, so, you know, he made some headway on it, but the headway only lasted, you know, obviously during his chairmanship. And then, you know, with the wave of criticism of banks, particularly, you know, with the financial crisis, this issue, you don't, it's not even real, it's not, it hadn't been on anybody's radar for a long time. But whether it'll be now on the radar in the new environment in Washington, this remains to be seen. I haven't heard about this issue recently, but I did think there was one interesting issue that points to this, one interesting example that points to this issue in a curious way. So there was one enforcement action the commission brought against Citigroup at the heart of the time, but it didn't have to do with the crisis, but it was at the heart of the weakness in Citi. And we're basically at the margin, the government-owned Citi, effectively. And there was like a $50 million, there was some big sanction, like $50 million. And the Division of Enforcement simply said, you know what, we're going to waive that. This is what the settlement says, but also what the settlement says, we're not going to try to collect, we're going to agree to take it, even though they kind of acknowledge, because we kind of realize that, well, it's really the taxpayers who are effectively the owners, and if we took this, we just have to provide. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting example that I think kind of relates to the sanction issue in a neat way. So that was one. And then the other point I would raise is, so one issue which hasn't been so controversial for a while is the issue of indemnification. So that's more on the personal side. And I think there's some interesting connections here. So in particular, I think everybody across the spectrum agrees those individual wrongdoers, we ought to throw the book at them. Sometimes there's a little bit of frustration. They fight hard. So that, therefore, the staff attorneys, they mostly like to go after the corporations because they don't fight so hard and they want to get scalps. Mm-hmm. But okay. But what is indemnification? Indemnification is they're insured. The employees are often, the key employees are often insured by the company or by an insurance company. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Well, I kind of indirectly learned why this is. Well, at first I thought, oh, this is some weird practice, some really bad practice. This kind of encourages people to do bad and dot, dot, dot. Well, I chatted with a very senior person at the commission when I was there, and I learned very quickly about this. He said something very insightful. He said to me, oh, when I was in private practice, we wouldn't negotiate a compensation arrangement that wouldn't have such a provision. This would be malpractice. And I said, oh, well, you're representing the executives. And I kind of sensed he wasn't, that he was representing the firms. He said, no, of course I was representing the firms. And then I realized, oh, what he's saying to me is the following. He's saying, yes, these contracts have indemnification because that's not only to the employee's benefit, it's to the company's benefit. And in effect, then I realized, oh, yeah, so the company's benefit because it's part of an efficient labor contract. Because this is a way to share these risks. Because a lot of the time, when the regulator tries to bring a case against you, you know, you may have made some inadvertent error, right. But if you're not going to be protected about this, you're going to demand more comp up front, and it's going to be more costly, and the company's in a better position to bear the risk. And I kind of thought, at some point, he didn't say all that to me, but then through my economics lens and thinking about this from a risk-sharing perspective, then I kind of started to understand that. But anyway, the point that I want to make is, oh, so this brings up another really interesting issue, which is, oh, so if the corporation is indemnifying, and if we do have legitimate concerns about corporate sanctions, we kind of come back almost, so who's at the margin? The stockholders may still be kind of at the margin. Let's maybe cut through a little bit because there's an insurance company in the picture.
Right.
All right, but let me, what are the other, so what didn't we, I think we kind of...
Yeah, the only other thing on my list really is the Equity Market Structure Advisory Committee, and you mentioned it.
Yeah, so so let's talk about that, and then we'll talk about some of the people I interacted with as we wrap up. Okay, so I've actually been on three, I've been on lots of committees actually of outsiders too, of critics and sometimes not so critics. I was a longstanding member of the Shadow Financial Regulatory Committee. It kind of had, you know, it's been a little bit of a critical kind of group. I've been a member of the Systemic Risk Council, originally founded by Sheila Bair. That's actually a more sympathetic group. Not so much in this space. They're really more focused on the financial stability space.
Right.
Although we at times had meetings with senior SEC people too. I was also a member of the initial Model Validation Council of the Fed, which provided them advice about how to look at the stress tests and how to validate those. But the one that I think maybe most closely tied to my commission experience would be this Equity Market Structure Advisory Committee. I think one of the main things there that I've been the most pleased with is potentially moving ahead with a pilot on make or take pricing. And I think some of the distortions associated with that are also really highlighted in my work with Jim Angel and Larry Harris, which is really when I started to learn about those issues. And while we don't do formal analysis of it, we have sort of an informal discussion, but it's actually kind of, you know, people have really kind of picked up on that in the academic community too, about what some of the distortions and some of the frictions are. And but also, I think in this context, one of the things I've kind of learned is that the buy side, the big institutional investors, they're not very happy about this structure. I mean, because I think they just think it's kind of, it creates a lot of distortion, basically. Right. And, you know, I think a pilot, this may be very constructive, and I think here, I think a pilot may be much more constructive than I think it is likely to be on, let's say, tick size, for example. You know, will the, you know, so what's the current status of the committee? Well, we were initially appointed for 2 years toward the end of the 2 years, Chairman White and the commission, you know, asked if we would extend for 6 months, and we agreed to do that. And I think the idea was to give the incoming chair flexibility as to, you know, if he wanted to go forward with a structure like this, and that'll be in his. You know.
From your perspective, was that structure working?
I think it worked pretty well.
It was to get external ideas into the
absolutely. And I think we had a good mix. Now, there were some complaints about the membership. Some of the leading complaints came from some of the platforms because they felt they weren't represented. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, you know, I felt, I thought having, first of all, I thought the membership was pretty good. I thought having significant representation from the buy side, I thought that was healthy. It seems to me like they're the ones, maybe more so than the platforms. The platforms have a vested interest. You know, particularly the large exchanges. A couple of the large exchanges, they kept complaining to the media they weren't represented. Well, I know that the subcommittee I'm on NMS, we invited them. To work with us, to meet with us, in effect, we were going to give them membership within our subgroup, you know. But I think they were more interested in making these pronouncements that they weren't involved. I think to give them more optionality. You know. So we brought in others to kind of give us breadth and perspective. But I think the committee's been working. I think the committee's worked pretty well. But you know, obviously, it's the prerogative of the new chair.
We'll see what happens.
You know, to decide how he wants to kind of organize in the space. But I think I think we've laid the foundation for potentially some important issues. And you know, and I think help put the market structure issues back on the commission's radar. You know, for a long time, you know, I made reference before that the crisis kind of had taking the steam out of a bunch of stuff.
Right.
But also Dodd-Frank obviously did. And certainly, you know, even within the commission, you know, most of the people at the commission will acknowledge this. I mean, some will publicly speak about this.
Yes.
And others, you know, at least informally kind of acknowledge, you know, there was so much Dodd-Frank that an equity market structure wasn't really tied into that. I think Flash Boys actually helped put it back on the radar. I think that was maybe one of the main contributions
of
Flash Boys.
Well, the Flash crash.
And a little bit the Flash, but that was so long ago now. So that only put on the radar some specialized kind of issues. So some narrow issues like about circuit, you know, about the circuit breakers and the like.
Do you want to talk about some of the people that you were?
Yeah. So you know, I felt most of the people in my group were terrific. Many of them have emerged in interesting ways. They have emerged, you know, the way it's interesting to follow the evolution of their careers. One of my staff members, a fellow who I made a permanent employee of the commission on the way in, was this fellow named Mike Pivovar. Mike had been basically a visiting academic at the commission, and he applied for one of our open positions, and I was pleased to be able to hire him, and he was a very talented staff member, and then obviously, you know, later he did other things in Washington, and you know, at some point working at the White House, both under Presidents Bush and Obama, and then being a chief economist for the minority at Senate Banking Committee, and you know, then in his role at the Commission, he was one of my staff members. My deputy Jonathan Sokobin was terrific. Jonathan. Later on, he moved over to the OFR in a senior position there, and he was at some point in some of the later transitions. I think he was actually the acting chief economist internally. Then later on, he moved over to the OFR, and from there he was hired to be the first chief economist at FINRA, and I think he's played a very important role at FINRA in heightening. You know, and I think they've done some really, really nice things in facilitating access to data. I think one of the things the SEC has done a poor job at has been to facilitate access to data by outsiders. And I think FINRA has done just the opposite. They've done a very nice job of facilitating access to data by outsiders, and therefore helping to facilitate what we learn about markets. Another one of my talented staff members. Actually, I just read his name in the Washington Post yesterday. In an interesting context, an amusing context. So his name, fellow by the name of Rob Fisher, who was part of my enforcement team, but who had very broad skills. He was a Harvard Law graduate and an economist, a sophisticated economist. Later on, he moved from my group to become one of the senior people in international affairs, and I think at some point was the acting director. So why was he in the news recently? Well, I just was reading a book review of a new book, a 1,500-page biography, a 1,450-page biography of President Obama, a new biography, and Rob was mentioned in passing in the Washington Post piece. Well, why was that? Because he was at Harvard Law School. He was good friends with the president. With the president. But who were some of the other people that I interacted with a lot? Well, I clearly interacted a lot with the various directors of market regulation. Eric Seery, who I've known for many years because he's a fellow financial economist and a good friend. Obviously, I interacted a lot with Annette Nazareth, and after she became a commissioner, but before before Eric was hired, with Bob Colby, who was the acting head, and then Bob later on after he left the commission, well, first he went into private practice with one of the DC law firms, but then he moved to FINRA actually as the chief legal officer there. Well, who were some of the others that I interacted with? Well, of course, senior people in the Division of Enforcement, Steve Cutler. Who obviously saw the financial crisis, then later on at a different vantage point being general counsel at J.P. Morgan Chase. I didn't have any connection with the then, by the way. I'll be clear about that. You know, for much of my time, Linda Thompson was the head, and I interacted a lot with her. I also interacted a lot with Peter Bresnan, particularly who was the deputy, or one of the deputies at least. I interacted with Peter, particularly with respect to these mutual fund market timing matters. Obviously, I interacted a lot with the heads of corporate finance. The first half of the time I was there, Alan Beller, and then the second half of the time I was there, John White. Husband of Mary Jo. I interacted, of course, a lot also with the head of investment management. Initially, when I arrived, Paul Roy, and then later Buddy Donahue. I also interacted a fair bit with the chief accountant, particularly the initial chief accountant when I was at the SEC, Don Nicolaisen, who I thought was a terrific chief accountant. So one other one other, just, you know, in terms of the, you know, the landscape and how, you know. So let me, I have a couple of comments about markets, just about broader market structure. One of the kind of things it's helpful to just, I think, identify is, so over a long stretch of time, how has equity market structure really changed? So this is not so much a comment about when I was at the commission, but just to provide a little bit more historical context about it. So I point to a couple of things. The things I see as maybe the most important developments in the equity market structure arena, I would say are the introduction of the options market. If I look back over the last 40, 45 years, the things I would point to are the introduction of the options markets. That was in spring of 1973. That was contemporaneous with, and here's my perspective as a finance professor, with the development of the option pricing model, the Black-Scholes-Merton model, both in continuous time and in binomial form, the Cox-Ross-Rubinstein model. These models and the markets, these really led to the develop. I think really heightened the use and the development of our derivative whole derivative security apparatus. Then I think after that, I would point to May 1st, 1975, the deregulation of commissions, tremendously important, certainly. I mean, to think that the commission levels used to be not so different than the commission levels on selling houses. Right. And then I think I would point, of course, to the NASDAQ. We briefly, you know, touched on that and how the collusion, tick size, and all that in the NASDAQ. Then I would point to NMS, and especially the demise of the New York Stock Exchange specialist, which I view as one of the principal contributions of NMS. Oh, and of course, how could I forget the crash of '87?
Right.
Tremendously important. Obviously, in the broader financial landscape, there obviously were other developments too. The internet bubble, and then SOX. And of course the financial crisis.
Reg ATS is in there too.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Absolutely. Reg ATS obviously important as well. You know, in terms of how the market structures have evolved and played out.
So, do you expect to see the change continue at a breakneck pace, or are things going to settle down and adjust in a new track?
I do think things will continue to change. Yeah, because, you know, technology is still evolving. Technology platforms have become more and more decentralized, and I think that may have implications that we don't yet understand. So I think that's basically what I would point to with respect to the markets. One other aspect in the market. So one aspect which from the perspective of today, my lens is now a little bit different. So when I was at the commission, we were starting to hear a lot of criticism of SOX, or at least the way the SEC was implementing SOX. We heard a lot of criticism, actually from the members of Congress. And some of this was because they were hearing, of course, from their constituents. Right. And so a lot of this came from small business. And in fact, it was bipartisan criticism. You know, there was no question about that. And it was interesting, you know, with hindsight, first of all, the fact that it was bipartisan criticism. And so Senator Kerry from Massachusetts, he was very active in, you know, communicating views of small business which were communicated to him, and just as an example. It was interesting. There were a lot of concern about, maybe not so much from the members of Congress, but there was lots of concern by foreign platforms about the changes in the U.S. regulatory environment, and they felt that their companies were now trapped. The companies who were like joint listed here felt that they were trapped, and then so the SEC kind of came up with ways to kind of ease back on that front. Oh, and if I could just circle back to kind of the early, so that's basically, I guess, that's basically what I would say about the markets.
Okay.
If I circle back to kind of the earlier part of our, maybe you know, I probably should have said earlier, just a couple of other points I would highlight.
Sure.
So when we talked about, you know, I talked a little bit about the issues that I'm sort of interested in as an academic in other spaces. We talked about mortgages and taxes and asset allocation in addition to my market structure interests. So I should also point out an important role I've had in the academic community. I was one of the founders of the Review of Financial Studies. We were founded in the mid-1980s, and we immediately emerged as one of the three major journals in the finance discipline, along with the Journal of Finance and the Journal of Financial Economics. And even to this day, these are really the three journals in finance that lead the leading and, you know, both leading departments and even secondary departments are looking to for lots of assistance in their evaluation process. But the journal basically emerged very quickly as one of the elite journals in the discipline, and I think it helped broaden the types of research that were being encouraged. You know, I should also say that being at the commission was a tremendous growing experience for me. You know, it helped me make the transition from being a theorist by training, as I sort of sometimes refer to myself, to being somebody very comfortable vetting empirical things and undertaking empirical projects and efforts, and it really broadened my perspectives about institutions and our markets. And indeed, one of the things I learned that's really striking to me is how much our capital markets are looking to the information in those SEC filings of various stripes, by the way, and the extent to which these filings are, in some respects, the lifeblood of our capital markets. This was something I sort of dare say I was probably close to clueless about when I arrived in Washington. I didn't really understand how deeply this mm-hmm. plays a central role in our regulatory process. I should also say that I was very very fortunate. You know, I mentioned early on in the interview the recent passing of Steve Ross. I should say that I was very fortunate to have him as my mentor. It really instilled within me he was a preeminent theorist and so a terrific role model, but it also instilled within me a deep understanding of the connection between theory and markets, between theory and empirics, the power of basic principles and simplicity, the importance of basic arbitrage principles, the importance of thinking through the mechanisms by which data is generated, and so that's been very helpful to me both throughout my career and I think even especially during my work at the commission.
That's a great thought to put on. Thank you very much.
I hope I didn't take too much time.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
This was very interesting.
Pleasure.